Good morning, everyone. It is October 14th, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom. I am your host, Frank, the exiled teacher, banned from the classroom this year because I cannot abide the masking rules that are inflicted upon teachers and students. Today, we're going to be talking about liberty. And liberty in the classroom. Halloween is a great time to talk about liberty in the classroom and to continue to teach the Liberty Unit. We started with day one last week, so make sure you go look that podcast up, How to Introduce Liberty to Your Students. It includes an amazing experiment activity to do in class. Works every time. Highly recommend it. Now, Halloween, it's the second best day, right, to celebrate freedom worldwide, because today, well, I'll just quote Mean Girls. In girl world, Halloween is the one day a year when a girl can dress up like a total slut and no other girls can say anything else about it. But it's not just girl world, right? Anyone can dress up like anything on Halloween and no one else can say anything about it. Complete liberty of fashion. Complete freedom of fashion, and as I always say, clothes are the beginning of manners and your most personal machine. It's true. The only thing that might interfere, of course, is the weather. We've got most of our trees losing most of their leaves by this point up here in the Adirondacks, High Peaks region of the Adirondacks. So the weather sometimes dictates your Halloween fashion choices, but hey, on the other hand, that's why we built houses, right? That's your second most personal machine, as Le Corbusier said, right? A house is a machine for living in. So Halloween, perfect time, the season of revelation, as the leaves fall from the trees and you can see more than you used to be able to see. Second best time to celebrate freedom. First best time, of course, is July 4th, for obvious reasons. So let's get back to our curriculum. On the first day, we did the fantastic trade activity with the candy and the rankings. Hopefully that went well for you. Now let's talk about the second day and the third day. Second day, it is not quite as exciting as the first day, but it is still excellent nonetheless. The goal of the second day is to find out what your students already know about liberty. This is not like a math curriculum. This is not like a French curriculum where you know, or hopefully you know, depending on your district or your school's vertical alignment, you know what skills kids are coming into your class with. You know what they've learned already. You know what the subjects were last year that the students studied within your field. Liberty is out there. Liberty is not something that there is a set K through 12 curriculum for. Tear, sadness, there certainly ought to be. It should be in history class, it should be in civics class, but we don't really do civics anymore, do we? So your job on the second day as a teacher is to figure out what your students know about liberty already. And you're going to do that by means of the classic piece of paper, a worksheet, a survey, a questionnaire, and tell the kids there are three parts to it. Three parts of the survey and the knowledge of liberty. Tell them what you're doing. You're trying to find out what they already know about freedom and liberty. And there are three parts to the survey. One, it's moral justification. Two, what it looks like in practice. And three, its effects in practice. I'm just going to go through these briefly so we can get to day three. Day three is much more hands-on. Day three is much more technical. But day two is necessary. So I will give you a little bit of guidance on it here. It's a survey. You can create your own, but I'll give you a little bit of guidance here. And you break it into those three parts. In general, right, you want to have three new starts every 45 minutes of class period, 15 minutes or less between starts. Your first, sometimes a little bit longer, you want to vary it. You know, it's just like writing. You don't want every paragraph to be the same length. So I shouldn't say 15 minutes or less, but about every 15 minutes, a new start. So I always started with a science fact of the day in classrooms. You can do hello, you can do how are you, you can do bell ringers at the start of class, however you like to do it. After, you know, how was the soccer game last night? How are the sports teams at the school doing? Things like that. After 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, if it's a science fact of the day, something educational, then you go on to the second start of the class, which is this piece of paper, this worksheet that you're handing out. Now, it has all the questions on it. And I'm going to give you some ways to make this spicier and more interesting. And you tell them, we're going to take this to find out what you know already. So I also want to know, right, to make it more interesting, you tell them, in addition to how much you know about Liberty, I also want to know how much you know about your classmates. Right? This always perks the kids up. They always want to know about classmates. They love talking to each other and about each other. So you pick a kid, any kid that volunteers, just take one kid to volunteer. This works for anything, by the way, not just a worksheet on Liberty. You should do this on other things too that otherwise might be a little bit dull. To spice up a worksheet, here's what you do. You pick a kid, you get a volunteer. If you don't have a kid who's volunteering to be the kid, maybe you have to cajole the kid a little bit, coax a little bit. But if you don't get a volunteer, you know, that's a bit of a red flag. And a lot of teachers don't even realize that that's a red flag, at least if you're teaching in this style. You might want to go back and look at how you can make kids more comfortable volunteering in your classroom. I've been on some field trips sometimes with teachers, and I say, well, okay, after this point, we'll ask them to share their journals. And teachers will say, who's going to share their journal? I can recall vividly a couple field trips like this where we were journaling about our trip, and at the end of the day, to recap what you've done, you share your journal and you get some people to share. And I've had teachers object and say, who's going to share their journal? And look, guys, if you're doing it my way, the question is, who isn't going to share their journal? Now, I'm not saying my way is the best way, right? There are multiple effective teaching methods. If you want to scare your class, if you want to make people uncomfortable sharing, that can work. You can get kids to learn that way, right? Machiavelli, the love versus fear split. You can use fear to get your kids to learn, absolutely. That does work. Multiple methods are effective. But, you know, I prefer the comfortable atmosphere. I prefer not to use fear. So if you don't have kids who are comfortable volunteering, you know, and you are trying to go for that comfort, then go back and reassess and see what you're doing that's preventing kids from feeling comfortable enough to share in your class. So you pick this kid who's going to volunteer, and that's Billy, let's say. And, you know, so you got, okay, look on this page. I've got all these questions on here, and then you've got the spot for the answers. And then over to the right of that, you have the Billy column. Label it Billy, right? And so they write down Billy's name over there. And then you pick something. You pick anything for the day. It could be whatever. I like to do maybe animals on the first day. Don't get too wild on the first time you're doing this. And then you say, all right, so as you're going along, in the Billy column, for every question you answer, you write down what animal this question made Billy think of. And of course, Billy on his sheet, he's going to write down what animal it made him think of. Now, he can't share. He can't share. That would be unfair. And then at the end, as you're going through the answers with everybody, every third question, every fifth question, every tenth question, however many you need to do, you stop with the topic of the day, whether it is nuclear science, whether it is trigonometry, whether it is Liberty, as it is in this lesson plan. And every so often in the questions, as you're going over them with the class, you stop and you say, all right, who knows what Billy thought of for an animal in this question? It sounds silly, but the kids love it, and they go wild for it. In fact, they've never done anything like it, and it's a great way to get to know other people in the class. Great conversation starter. I highly recommend it. Just do it. Just try it already. Brings your class together. That helps them make feel comfortable, because then they see that, oh, I can volunteer for these things, and it's fun. People get to know what animals I think about, right? And I know it sounds silly, but it works. It's awesome. So do it. And if, you know, you can do, instead of animals, if you're not the creative type, you know, you can do, you know, what soft drink. This made Billy think of, or you could do what video game this makes Billy think of. You can do all kinds of things like that. You can even do, once you get to a real point of comfort in your class, you can do things like, who does Billy think will get this question right? You got to be real careful with things like that, though. Got to build up a lot of trust first. All right. So then, what are your questions going to be? Well, I said, remember, we have the three sections, and the first section is moral justification. So questions you could have in here to see what they already know about liberty or what their current schema is on liberty. You say, is it moral to seize someone else's property? Is it moral for the government to seize someone else's property? Is it moral for one group to do something that an individual can't? Is the idea of property moral? Should we abolish all property to begin with? Do you have a right to your life? Do you have a right to your labor? Things like this. Ask some questions like that. And then in the second part, what does it look like in practice? Then you say, well, put these governments, you give them a list of governments, you give them a list of historical situations, and you give them a spectrum of socialism on one end, capitalism on the other end, just like an x-axis or like a timeline and history graph, statist on one end, non-statist on the other. Label them both that way, socialist and statist on one end, and capitalism and non-statist on the other end. You can even write in, less free and more free if you wish. And then give them a list of countries, list of governments, and not just current ones, but throughout history also, and have them place them on that axis, either towards the more socialist side or the more free side. Then you also ask questions in the second, like in the section, like in a market, do you need a license for selling these things? And you list everything from tomatoes to plastic surgery, and you have them check off if they if those products ought to require a license before being sold in a market. And then you ask who gives out those licenses, who ought to be giving out those licenses. And then you ask, the more restrictive your licensing gets, does that move you toward the statist socialist end, or does that move you toward the non-statist capitalist end of the spectrum? And finally, you end that section with a question, a short answer question, probably the first short answer question of the survey. You want to keep it short, you want to keep it sweet, easy for them to answer. You ask, how is a capitalist market different from a socialist market? Give them some space to answer that. Finally, in part three, which is the part where you say, what have the effects been of a capitalist or a libertarian or a free market in place versus effects of a socialist government in place? You ask questions in here, and the first one, you go back to the countries that you ranked above. You put a heart underneath them if their quality of life is above what you are experiencing right now. You write a star next to the country if it is more capitalist than your country is right now. Use your phone, look up Freedom House, look up other places that might rank the freedom or the capitalist nature of a country. Absolutely use your phones, right? If you're not using your phone in class, come on. Come on, teachers. You have to use phones in class, right? Imagine that someone came here from the year 1970 or the year 1980, and you said to them, oh, yeah, sure. We do have these little devices in our pocket now that contain access to the entire world's knowledge. But no, we don't use them in school. Are you kidding? We can't let the kids use those things in school. Yeah, well, if you did that, then the person that traveled here from 1970 or 1980 would be like, WTF, bro. What are you saying? Are you kidding me? You have these devices in your pocket that allow you to have access to the entire world's knowledge, and you're telling the kids not to use them? TF, bro, right? And then, just to conclude this little piece, understand that I am that guy. Anybody who's 41 years or older has, in fact, traveled here from the year 1980. Anybody who's 51 years or older has traveled here, in fact, from the year 1970. We are time traveling at the rate of 1 second per second into the future. We are that guy. Right? So do not tell that guy that it's okay to have access to the entire world's knowledge in your pocket and yet ban that knowledge from school. That's not what you want to do as a teacher. Oof, sorry. A little pet peeve for me right there. A little pet peeve on that topic. All right. So in this last section, you know, first you go back with the hearts and the stars, like I say, heart under the countries that are better quality life than yours, star under the countries that are more capitalist than yours. And then you ask kids to look up in the next question, say life expectancy in Venezuela in 1990 versus today, and then how the government changed in Venezuela versus 1990 to today. Then you have them look up life expectancy in the United States in 2010 versus today, and how it changed, and how the country's government, has it gone from more socialist or more capitalist to less socialist or less capitalist since 2010. You can do that again for China from 1980 till now. And if you want to do the art project, the poster project, you can do things like cost of goods, picture collages of apartments, etc. You can have them paste on to the backside, or if you're doing this electronically, you can have them, you know, just download and cut and paste into there. And so then, as your last start of the day, right, you want to have three starts of the day. Your first one was your welcomes, your how are yous, your fact of the day, if you do a science fact of the day like I do. And then at the end, and then the middle was the survey, and then at the end of the lesson, you go over it. That's your new start, your last start of the day. Have everybody stand up, move around. They can write down, you can pick out a question that you think is the most important question for Billy's animal. Have everybody write their answer for it on the board. If you want, just get people moving around. There is value in pumping blood, a lot of value in pumping blood, in fact. And so then you go over the answers, as always, and you talk about them. And every third to 10th questions or so, like I said, you stop and you ask, who has Billy's prediction for this? Or you can do it for every question if you can do it quickly. And you see who got it right. You give them 28 self-esteem points if they matched Billy's animal, if they matched what it made Billy think of. All right, so by the way, 28 self-esteem points. You can also use Hershey's Kisses if you want. You can also use an NFT if you've made NFTs for your class. And if you haven't made NFTs for your class, I mean, it's pretty easy to do. You can go out and do that. Kids love it. All right, now we're on to day three. Day three of your Liberty curriculum. What do you do on day three? Well, it's fantastic. What do you do? Well, you play The Price is Right. It's amazing. Start out first 5 minutes, you know, how you doing, what's going on. And the second part of, and then your second start is you talk about The Price is Right. And you ask them, do you know about Price is Right? And some people haven't seen the game show, shame on them. And then you say, well, the guesses on that show, believe it or not, have changed a lot since Eric and Hyde and Mila Kunis and everybody else were blazing up in their basement in the 1970s. Things have changed a lot on that 70s show. Things have changed a lot on The Price is Right. Do you think the guesses have become more accurate or less accurate? There's a super big trend, and we should look at that. So ask them, always ask them first, give them a chance to think. They'll start talking out loud, hopefully, if you have a comfortable classroom. And you give them hints on how to think, right? Schools so often say that they teach kids how to think, not what to think, but they don't really teach kids how to think. But here's your chance. Here's your chance. You say, all right, so while you're thinking of it, while you're making a guess, how do you make a good guess? Obviously, the first choice, it's too late now, but you prepare and increase your knowledge base by reading a lot ahead of time, right? So when you're asked these questions, you are ready to know. Second, you use your second brain. The internet is your second brain. It's terraforming for artificial intelligence. The internet is definitely terraforming for artificial intelligence, but before they're here, we can use the internet, and it's our second brain. So go ahead and use your second brain. That's your second hint. Your third hint is to think in principle. How do you think in principle? Well, you have these general rules that apply to all sorts of different situations in life. And when you encounter something that you are not necessarily on firm ground in, that you don't necessarily know the exact right answer for, you use a principle. You fall back on principle. So what principle might apply here? Well, you do know that the world has become richer since the 1970s. So do you have a principle about people, and do they pay more or less attention to price as they get richer? Right? You can think in principle. It is a very powerful way to think. Have principles that apply. And maybe the principle that might apply here is, do people pay more or less attention to price as they get richer? You should have an answer to that in your principle. And then you say, all right, you've had plenty of time to think about it. What do you think? Have the answers on the Price is Right become more accurate or less accurate? And of course, you tell them, they have become much, much less accurate. To be specific, in the 1970s, the average guess was about 8% below, because you can't go over, you're busted if you go over. The average guess in the 1970s was about 8% the correct number, and now the average guess is about 20% below the right number. So you know, just a straight up percentage drop, 8% to 20% right there. That is huge. Another way to think of it is the amount by which they have been wrong has more than doubled. It's increased by about 250% since the 1970s. This is a huge effect, an enormous effect. Nobody knows exactly why it is, but does it match up to your principle that the more people get rich, the richer people get, the less attention they pay to prices, to expenditures? Yeah, maybe it does seem to match up to that principle. Is that proof that that principle is correct? Absolutely not. It's not proof, but it is at least consistent with it. All right, so then you say you're going to play some Price is Right. Here we go. Come on down. And you say, do you guys know how to play? And if they don't know how to play, you say, okay, well, I am not explaining it to you. Never explain the rules of a game. Never explain the rules of a game. I will say that one more time. It actually goes for everything. Never explain. If what you're doing in the classroom requires instruction, then it is too complicated, right? If what you're doing requires instructions on how to do it, it's too complicated. I can't tell you how many teachers I've seen out there lose their class before the activity even starts because they waste time going over the instructions. Change your process until it's obvious. Even if you're doing a chemistry lab, safety, you have to do safety because it's required. So at the beginning of the year, you go over safety, you go over goggles. But then if you can't just give a page out to your class and say, do this experiment, then it's too complicated, right? Now, there's a lot of value in walking through kids through an experiment too. I do that a lot of times because it will help them understand what's on the page. But walking somebody through something is not the same as giving instructions. And I only do that for labs because it should not take more than a minute either. Should not take more than a minute. I'm talking 60 seconds. Okay. All right. So don't give any instructions. Just play the game. So you call people down, right? You get five people in front of the classroom, five people here, five people here, and then you put up a picture. Don't give them any instructions. Stop it. I can tell you're thinking about giving instructions. Don't do it. They will get it. Trust your kids. Okay. So you put up this picture on the board. You've got five kids on one side, maybe five kids on another side, so you can take the average. And you say, all right, or if you have a small class, just get five kids total, three kids here, three kids there. It just depends on the class size. You figure it out. So you project the picture on the board. For the first picture, you put down the first item is the entire life's work of the world's most richly gifted genius in the English language ever. And you show a picture of Shakespeare. Underneath it, you write entire life's work, and you have it titled The Entire Life's Work of the World's Most Richly Gifted Genius of the English Language. And then you say, all right, you're going to submit your bids, but not in terms of dollars. You're going to submit your bids in terms of hours worked at McDonald's. How many hours do you need to work at McDonald's to have that value equal to the value of the entire life's work of the world's most richly gifted genius in the English language? You have 15 seconds. I need an answer in terms of how many hours worked at McDonald's is equal to the entire life's work of the world's most richly gifted genius of the English language. Go. And you give them 15 seconds, right? And there'll be screams and there'll be laughter and there'll be, you know, people saying, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Too bad, they were told they got 15 seconds. After 15 seconds, you say, all right, I need your answers. Hold them up on your whiteboards, on your piece of paper that you hold up. If you're doing it online, just, you know, have them write it online, okay? And you go down. All right, Susie, what's your answer? Jennifer, what's your answer? Linda, what's your answer? Hayden, what's your answer? And they all write down how many hours, right? You think you have to work at McDonald's to have your work at McDonald's equal to the entire life's work of the world's most richly gifted English language genius, Shakespeare. And of course, some kids will maybe get it right, see what their bids are. And of course, some kids might write down you need to work 1,000 hours at McDonald's to have your work be valued at the same as the world's most richly gifted genius in English. Some kids might write down 20 hours. Some people might write down infinity hours worked at McDonald's is still not equal to Shakespeare's entire life's work. And then you say, okay, you all have your bids, and you see what their bids are. And then you say, all right, here is the correct answer. And you change to the next slide, and you show the Riverside Shakespeare at Amazon in a used copy for $10. So the correct answer is two-thirds. Two-thirds of an hour worked at McDonald's is equal to the value of the entire life's work of the world's most richly gifted genius of the English language. And you say, did you get that right? Ooh-hoo-hoo. Maybe one did. Maybe two did. Maybe zero did. Some are probably way over. If they did get it right, you say, great job. Even if you think they were just trolling and guessing by putting down 0 hours or a fraction of an hour, you say that's awesome. All right? Because you never assume that somebody's trolling. Never, never, never assume that somebody's trolling. You always give them the benefit of the doubt. Assume that your students are being honest. You just have to do it that way. All right. So you give them their moment in the sun, give them 280 self-esteem points if they have that correct. And then you point out that a lot of people might have had this wrong because they thought that, wow, this is the world's most richly gifted genius in the English language, and its entire life's work is equal to the value of less than an hour of your friend, you know, Andrea, working two-thirds of an hour at McDonald's, right? And your friend Jason over there, he's not even doing very well in English class at all. Like, he wrote his essay on Hamlet, and he was like, oh, Ophelia is pretty much, you know, awesome, because in Chance the Rapper's lyrics, he rhymed it with Ophelia, which is great. Second best Chance the Rapper rhyme ever after Rhombus and the Bombast. Chance has very good educational related rhymes, if you want to look that up. So, you know, that guy Jason over there, he's rhyming with his Hamlet essay, and yet he can go and work for 45 minutes at McDonald's or less, 40 minutes, and have that be the same value as the entire life's work of the world's most richly gifted genius in the English language. This is crazy, right? Would you have thought that? Yes, students, maybe not. Maybe you did. Let's do some more rounds, and you call some more people down. And the next round you bid on, you put up on the slide, you get your five more kids down there, and you say you have strep throat, life-threatening when untreated, you need to buy a prescription's worth of amoxicillin. And you show a picture up there of amoxicillin pills, you label it like I just said, strep throat, life-threatening when untreated, you need to buy a prescription's worth of amoxicillin. And have them bid in terms of hours of your teacher's salary. Now, don't be afraid. It's public. Don't be afraid. If you really don't want to do yours, do like a first-year teacher's salary. It's public information if you're in a public school. So do that. And amoxicillin is about $20 a bottle. So the correct answer is, you know, the way we teachers work and first-year teacher salary is like maybe 1 hour or something. Okay? And then next up, you get a group and you do one more silly one, and maybe it's Lindsay Lohan's Fursona NFT, right? Her non-fungible token. She sold herself as a fursona, a furry personality. You explain what an NFT is. And this one, you bid them, you have them bid in terms of days of meals for a homeless person in New York City. Okay, so in other words, the value of the non-fungible token of Lindsay Lohan's fursona versus how is equal to the value of how many days of meals for a homeless person in New York City, right? And how many homeless person days is equal to one Lindsay Lohan fursona? And of course, the answer is, according to the Wall Street Journal, November 2019, 870 a day or 869 a day to feed a homeless person for a day in New York City. So, and I think the NFT sold for about $4,000. So it's like 450, 460 days of feeding a homeless person is equal to one Lindsay Lohan fursona. That's the value that you get there. Now, no judgments. We're not saying whether this is right or not. This is just what it is. This is just what it is. And ask them if they knew that. You'll get answers all over the board. And the point here, well, we'll get to the point at the end. Next up, you do the classic one with water and diamonds. And if you have a super advanced class, you could talk about marginal utility, right? But you say, put up there water, and you put up there a 1-carat diamond, and you say, water obviously can save your life, but how many, bottles of Evian? Always use Evian because it's naive backwards and because it has the best commercials. Evian, how many bottles of Evian is equal to a 1-carat diamond? And Evian can save your life if you're 3 days without water, but you can go 3 days without a diamond and you'll live. So what's the value? And you have them guess it. You can do all kinds of things. One of my favorite one is to do a full grown ass meat cow in terms of Yeezys, right? In terms of Yeezy shoes. And a full grown ass meat cow is about $5,000, and Yeezys are about 500. So it's about 10 Yeezys. 10 Yeezys will get you a grown ass meat cow, right? Yeezy shoes. And it's fun, right? It's fun. Shatner just took a trip into space, right? So you can do the trip Shatner took into space in terms of Erika Jayne's salary for appearing on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. That was just disclosed. And so Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, she was about $600,000, and Blue Origin's not quite disclosing the prices yet, but roughly 10 million, 10 million over 600,000, about 17 times. So 17 years of Real Housewives on Beverly Hills equal to 1 4-minute space trip. Would they have known that? And Shatner's net worth like 100 million, so a tenth of his net worth. And would they have known that? I don't know. You can do more fun stuff. Price of a cheeseburger to a pound of wool. That usually works out about 10 pounds of wool is worth one cheeseburger. Bring it back down to earth that way, make it a little more concrete. And they can see, commodity markets and things like that, how this would be useful in a commodity market. And you say, okay, now what is the point of playing this game? Point of this game is to learn about prices. You did not know a lot of these. You weren't even close on a lot of these. So how do you know? How do you figure out how many pounds of wool should be worth a cheeseburger? How do you figure out how many Yeezys should be worth a cow? How do you figure out what a person might be willing to pay for Lindsay Lohan's fursona versus what a person is willing to donate to homelessness in New York City to feed a homeless person for a day? How do you find this out? The point is that prices are information. That is what they should be learning about this. That is what you want to tell them to learn about this. You say that prices are information. Is the market giving us information that we otherwise wouldn't have? What factors might influence the price? On the fourth day, well, you should ask it now and then you should move into the fourth day. The fourth day is how is price different from cost? What if there were more rules put in place by the government or whoever's running the market that said how many pickles you had to have on your burger? And you had to have some inspector come and inspect that. Would that tend to raise the price or lower the price? Would it raise the cost or lower the cost? You can do that maybe a little bit more on the fourth day. In a society where people are allowed to trade more freely, do you get more accurate information? in a society where people are not allowed to trade freely, do you get less accurate information? What will this do to supply of goods? What will it do to quality of life if you have prices go up, prices go down? And then for homework, you should probably start moving into homework, definitely if you didn't do it the first day or the second day. And homework, you say, research how free market gives you information. Research maybe the Bitcoin mining incident of mispricing electricity in Venezuela, right? What went wrong with Bitcoin mining in Venezuela, where electricity prices were set without real information on what people were willing to pay for electricity? And will these effects reoccur in other places? What are some examples of goods that have had their prices set or an artificial floor, an artificial ceiling imposed on them right now? Do these prices tend to increase liberty or decrease liberty? Do they tend to increase supply or decrease supply? Do they increase safety or decrease safety, right? And then that will lead into day four, which is going to be about cost and price gouging relative to price and demand and supply. Hopefully they have those concepts from economics. If they don't, and let's face it, they probably don't, then you can talk about them then too. But hey, that's just like trying to teach physics when people can't solve 12 divided by x equals 4, which, if you're not aware, that is about the state of physics education these days. And only about 10% of people in New York State take physics class in high school, of students take a physics class in high school. So yes, maybe part of it is because if 12 divided by x equals 4 is difficult, then physics, it does not seem like something that you can tackle. It's frustrating, but things are looking up in terms of technology. Things are looking up in terms of people like us being able to communicate out here and this community that we're slowly building around liberty here in the ADK homeroom. So find me on Twitter at ADK homeroom and help build that community of liberty and education. We will get back to part 3 in this series, which covers day 4. Real soon. Tomorrow, of course, we have the dumbest pop culture moments of the week and Poetry Friday. Take care.